Chapter 86. When Tamara Elkin pulled back her front door, she looked exhausted and worried. He was exhausted himself, but the worries, at least for now, were gone. Jesse hugged her long and tightly. When they broke their embrace, she asked, "Is everything all right? I was watching the news and fell asleep on the couch. Is it done?"
"It was him."
"Marshawn?"
"Uh-huh."
"You arrested him?" "After he broke into my house and killed the hell out of the dummy we used to teach CPR. But you're fine. Marshawn confessed to everything. There won't be a trial." She smiled at him.
"He almost got away with it," Jesse said.
She shook her head. "You would have gotten him, eventually."
"Maybe."
She smiled again, but this was a different smile.
"What's that smile about?"
"Water in the lungs," she said.
"What about it?"
"There wasn't any, in either Dragao or Milner. So, unless they just happened to fall overboard the second after they both stopped breathing, someone would have had to push them overboard. You would have followed it back to Marshawn."
"We'll never know.
Tomorrow, compare the knife wounds in Milner to the wounds you found on Mary Kate's ribs. Marshawn says it was the same knife."
"Will do."
He kissed her softly on the forehead. "Thank you for doing this for me. How's Jameson?"
"He's asleep in the spare bedroom."
"God, I was so nervous. Jesse Stone, do you know how long it's been since I've had a living patient? Don't you ever do this to me again."
Now it was his turn to smile. "Should I take him back to the hospital now?"
"He'll be fine until tomorrow. I gave him something for the headache, but he's not showing any other symptoms. That man's had a rough life. The story his body tells is very sad."
"That's a pretty unclinical analysis, Doc."
"There's a reason I'm more comfortable working with the dead, Jesse."
He didn't say anything to that.
"Can I get a drink?"
"For a price," she said.
"Like?"
"I'll think about it."
"In the meantime, how about that drink?"
She hugged him. When she let go, she said, "This could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship."
"Depends."
"On?"
"If I ever get that drink."
"You are a persistent SOB, Jesse Stone."
"My most charming feature."
Without another word, she walked to her cabinet and twisted off the cap of a new bottle of Black Label.
Chapter 87. There was a false spring that late February. Temperatures hovered in the 50s, and southern New England hadn't seen snow since mid-January. Jesse had the softball team out for an early practice at the park. Mostly, he wanted to see what he had with this year's team. Things had changed since last season. They had new uniforms, just not the ones Bill Marchand had ordered. Their new sponsor, the Paradise Credit Union, had supplied them. Suit, who, owing to the gunshot wounds, had missed the bulk of last season, was back at first base. Jesse liked having him there, even though Suit's footwork around the bag wasn't quite what it used to be. Jesse had been forced to shift Tommy Deutsch to shortstop to take Marchand's place. Connor Cavanaugh had taken Deutsch's spot at second. Cavanaugh was all hit and no field, but on a softball team full of aging jocks, wannabes, and never-will-bes, there were only so many places to hide weak links. After practice, when they were at the Lobster Claw drinking beers and moaning about all the things that ached and speculating about how much worse they would ache tomorrow, Molly came into the Claw to join them. A few months back, Jesse thought, he would have dreaded Molly showing up unexpectedly. But after a few rough weeks of grief and regret, she had returned to her old self. And he was glad of that. It wasn't only Molly who had returned to normal. Paradise itself had been quiet through the winter and now seemed to be the same little town it was before the trauma of the fall. It had put the murders and scandal behind it and resumed the natural rhythm of things. In L.A., he understood how that worked. Big cities are rife with tragedy, so that one just swallowed up the next. Then he recalled Healy's words about small-town secrets and shame. And now Jesse guessed he understood about that, too. Molly waved for Jesse to come over to the end of the bar to talk.
"Beer?"
"Sure," she said. Jesse grabbed a pitcher and poured her a pint of Harpoon Lager.
"What's up?"
I heard from Drew Jameson today.
Jesse asked, how is he?
He says he's better, and asked me to have you thank your friend Dix for getting him into the program.
I'll do that. What'd you guys talk about?
Molly smiled that sad smile he hadn't seen on her face since the fall. Warren, it feels good to be able to talk about him again. He was lost to me, and Jameson brought him back.
Jesse was hesitant to say it, but in the end didn't hold back.
Warren covered up a murder for 24 years.
I know he did, she said, sipping her beer. I'm not excusing that.
I guess in the end he tried to do the right thing. He sure paid for it. A lot of people paid for it, Jesse. But what Jameson brought back to me was the Warren I knew for those few weeks before the world went upside down. Those were special days that are mine again.
I'll drink to that.
They clinked glasses and finished their beers in silence. When he was done, Jesse said his goodbyes.
Molly caught up to him at the door.
Jesse, I almost forgot.
What?
Remember the missing cab driver?
Wheatop?
Sure, what about him?
The Connecticut State Police called.
They found him dead in his car, in a small lake that thawed early. They emailed over the full report as an attachment.
Drowned? Jesse asked.
Broken neck.
Broken neck, huh? Just like Maxie Connolly.
Maxie Connolly threw herself off the bluffs, Jesse.
Or not.
We back to that again?
It's suspicious.
Thanks, Molly.
Jesse felt as achy as the rest of his team, and his shoulder was killing him. Nothing like the combination of stabbing pain and burning to let you know you're alive. He didn't go home. Instead, he walked back to the station and looked at the report from the Connecticut Stateies. It was all there. The written report of the troopers, the detective's report, the ME's report, autopsy photos, photos of the car, photos of the items found in the car with Wheatop's body. If he hadn't been a little buzzed from the beers, he would have spotted it the first time he looked at the photos. Then, when he scrolled through the photos a second time, he saw it. When he saw it, he knew. And the last unexplained bit of business from last fall fell cruelly into place. Chapter 88. The Parmenter House was one of the most beautiful houses in all of Paradise. People came from all over the states to see it. Unlike the muscular brick Victorians up on the bluffs, the Parmenter House was a full-out painted lady. It had two turrets, a wraparound porch, a widow's walk, eyebrow windows, all manner of gingerbread turnings, and a gazebo. There were at least 4 different kinds of siding used to adorn the outside, everything from fish scales to clapboards, and the color scheme involved an equal number of colors. It had once been home to Wexford Parmenter, a railroad man who'd relocated from Boston in the 1890s. He'd left the house to his son Wexford Jr., who had left it in turn to his daughter Corina, who had left it to her daughter Martha. Martha had willed it to her husband. Jesse knocked on Stu Cromwell's door. He supposed he could have bluffed his way through it and not waited for the lab results to come back. But to his way of thinking, Maxie Connolly's justice had already been months delayed, and he wasn't willing to risk losing an arrest because of his impatience. So he'd gotten a comparison sample and sent it to the state forensics lab to make sure it matched the DNA from the unknown contributor's hair and skin evidence they found on Maxie Connolly's panties. As he waited on the porch, he noticed some hints of green on the confused hedges that lined the property. If the weather stayed this warm for another week, he wondered if confused bees would come out and join the party. Stu Cromwell came to the door, and when he saw it was Jesse standing at his threshold, his body sagged, but he smiled. "I suppose I've been waiting for you to knock since the day the weather turned warm. Come in," he said. "Go into the parlor."
Jesse didn't step in. Instead, he pointed to the cruiser parked at the curb. "There's another car parked on Hemlock behind the house, so don't make this difficult." The 9mm in Jesse's hand still felt odd to him, though he had owned one for many years and had occasion to use it. He showed the semi-automatic to Cromwell. "And Stu, no martial arts heroics. I've got a black belt in bullets." "There won't be any trouble, Jesse, I give you my word. Please step in. I'll come out as soon as we're done talking."
Jesse went into the parlor and sat on a fussy brocade sofa with frills and tassels. The house looked a mess. Cromwell noticed Jesse notice.
"Since Martha passed, I haven't seen the point," he said.
"Drink?"
"I'll pass."
"Then I'll drink alone."
Cromwell poured some rye into a cut crystal tumbler. He didn't make any silly gestures or toasts. He just drank it.
Quickly poured himself another and drank it too.
He sagged even more.
"How did you know?"
"They found Wheattop's body in his car in a lake in Connecticut."
"I know that." He slammed the glass down against the marble fireplace, smashing it to pieces. "I put him there, for heaven's sakes. I just needed to buy time until Martha died. How did you know it was me?"
"You left a bottle of rye behind in the car. That was sloppy, and it made me curious. Wheattop was a vodka drinker, and frankly, Stu, you're the only person I know who drinks rye. Once I got curious, it was easy for me to find out that you and Martha owned the cottage on another lake less than 2 miles from where they found Wheattop."
"Did you think you were going to get away with it?"
"The bastard was trying to blackmail me, Jesse. He had the letter."
"The letter?"
"The one I wrote to Maxie all those years ago. There are things in that letter I couldn't have come to light while Martha was still alive. After all she had done for me, and with how she was suffering, I couldn't have it. I wouldn't have it. I suppose if I had any money to pay that scummy little man, I would have paid for his silence. But the cupboard was bare."
"Did you kill Maxie Connolly?"
Cromwell ignored the question. "I loved her once. I don't know, maybe it wasn't love at all. But she had me under her spell. I lived and breathed her. When I had her, I wanted her again. While I was still inside her, she was magical that way. And the silly part is, she really desperately loved me, too. Can you imagine a less likely pair?"
"But you're engaged to Martha."
"I was, but it didn't matter. I couldn't keep away from Maxie. I wrote these silly love letters to her. They were increasingly desperate. I was trying to explain to her how I couldn't give her up, nor could I break my promise to Martha. And in one letter, the one Wheattop found in his cab, I said some awful and foul things about Martha. I was just so lust-drunk and foolish. I had just never had a woman like Maxie. I was such an idiot. Once Maxie had the letter, she threatened me that if I didn't find a way to leave Martha on my own, she would show the letter to her and do it for me."
"You broke it off."
Cromwell nodded. "God, Jesse, you do understand. What else could I do? Maxie's threat was like a cold slap in the face, and I suddenly saw what I had done and with whom I'd gotten involved. I broke it off immediately after Maxie made the threat. I didn't care then if she showed the letter to Martha. It was better, I thought, than getting in any deeper with Maxie. But Maxie said she couldn't go through with it and that she was so sorry." He paused, drank directly from the bottle. "She said she was desperate, too, that she never thought she could have a smart man, a man with manners and class." He laughed joylessly at himself.
"But it was too late," Jesse said.
"Exactly. I suppose I never stopped lusting after her. I always dreamed about sleeping with her again, but she disgusted me as a human being. She was so coarse. When I wouldn't have her back, she went wild, trying to hurt me and punish herself by sleeping around with almost anyone. She would call me and tell me about them and the things they would do. It was so low of her, but that sort of thing was all she knew. It was the only weapon she had, and she used it. And even then, I..."
Cromwell drifted off, lost in the memories of the woman he'd murdered.
"So when Maxie came back for Ginny's funeral, what? Did she try to blackmail you?"
Cromwell shook his head.
"No, she offered to return the letters if I would only see her and be with her. She claimed that she had never stopped loving me, that she would do anything to make up for the mistake she had made 25 years before. So I agreed. We met at a spot up in the bluffs that used to be our rendezvous. I made her believe we were going to have one last tryst, and then I snapped her neck like a twig. I drove her farther down the bluffs and tossed her over."
"But you took her panties. Why?"
Cromwell stared at Jesse as if he were speaking Arabic. "Haven't you heard a word I said?"
Jesse moved on. "Did she have the letters with her?"
"Yes, I thought so.
Then why did you kill her? Jesse said. You didn't have to kill her.
But I did.
Why? I couldn't chance Maxie talking. Not after all that Martha had risked to buy the paper. She had risked everything for me. I couldn't let scandal and cancer eat up her last few months of life.
Is that what you tell yourself, Stu? Does it help you sleep at night?
Cromwell's face reddened, his voice strained.
What are you talking about? Of course that's why I killed Maxie. I had to.
No, you didn't. You had all the letters. At least you thought you did. Martha was in no state to care one way or the other.
No, Stu, sorry, Jesse said. I don't buy it.
The newspaper man bowed his head. She hurt me, Jesse, in the most profound way I have ever been hurt. Maxie took from me the only obsession I ever had. She ruined that, and for 25 years I bore what she did to me in my guts, like a slow-leaking balloon full of acid. There were times that I thought it would eat me alive. I had to end the pain.
How's that working for you, Stu?
I'm ready now. Jesse cuffed Cromwell and walked him out. When Peter Perkins got to the porch, Jesse recited the Miranda warning and told Perkins to take Cromwell to the station and book him.
You coming, Jesse? Perkins said.
In a little while. Jesse stood on the porch and watched Perkins load Cromwell into the back seat of the cruiser. The air, which earlier implied the scent of flowers, had turned a nasty shade of raw, smelling now only of chill and the sea. The late-day sun had disappeared behind a sickly gray veil of clouds, and the bare trees on the Parmenter property twisted in the gusts that had kicked up hard and mean. February had come back home to roost. Stepping down onto the granite path, Jesse wondered why victories were always short-lived, and why the taste of a win was never quite as sweet as the bitterness of losing. Someday, he would have to ask the devil.
This is James Naughton. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Robert Parker's The Devil Wins by Reed Farrell Coleman. This program was directed by David Rapkin. Executive producer, Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2015 by the estate of Robert B. Parker. Production copyright 2015, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.